Welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. I want to thank you for joining us on the show today. And for those of you who want to catch up on our previous episodes, remember to check out our website at voanews.com. We are also on all social media platforms, so be sure to connect with us on there too. Now, on today's show, we continue with our series exploring the impact of the COVID-19 global pandemic on Africa, especially the economic impact as people get back to work and governments grapple with containment measures to avoid major shocks in the healthcare systems or even their economies. The Africa Centers for Disease Control says that the continent has so far registered over 1.2 million cases of COVID-19 with around 29,000 deaths. Now, for some good news, South Africa, with the continent's highest burden of COVID-19, has reached the peak of its pandemic. That is according to the president and top health officials. President Cyril Ramaphosa recently announced a loosening of restrictions, but noted that he's not yet breathing a sigh of relief. VOA's Anita Paul reports from Johannesburg on how the nation reached this milestone.
A ray of hope for the Rainbow Nation, as the president announced that South Africa, with the continent's heaviest known burden of the coronavirus, has passed its viral peak since reporting its first cases in early March. President Cyril Ramaphosa, speaking late Saturday, said that over the past 3 weeks, the number of new confirmed cases has dropped from a daily average of about 12,000 to around 5,000 per day.
A ray of light is visible now on the horizon. Let us continue to exercise the greatest caution and care and remain ever vigilant. Let us continue to stand united in our determination to defeat this virus.
On the streets of Johannesburg Monday, residents had mixed feelings about the news. Robert Etzinger said while he was happy that the restrictions have eased, he wants more.
I feel as though it's lagging on too long. You know, the rest of the economy needs to get back into the swing of things. And the sooner we get over level two down to one, the sooner we can get the economy going and boost it again. That's my feeling.
The chair of South Africa's Advisory Committee on COVID-19, Dr. Salim Abdul Karim, credits the government's swift lockdown measures. He says the government gained about 6 to 8 weeks of precious time to prepare by declaring a state of disaster, closing schools, banning international travel, and banning the sales of alcohol and tobacco.
In the period where we are now just past the peak of the epidemic, we've been seeing a slowing down in the number of cases, so that we are now between 4,000 and 5,000 cases a day.
Ramaphosa also announced a loosening of restrictions, including allowing sales of tobacco and alcohol.
And guided by the advice of our health experts, the Medical Advisory Committee, and after consultation with provincial and local government, Cabinet has decided to place the entire country on alert level 2, with effect from midnight on Monday, the 17th of August 2020.
South Africa has at least 600,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the nation of nearly 60 million people. It is also at the forefront of coronavirus prevention, with scientists at the University of the Witwatersrand this week launching the nation's second vaccine trial. Karim says the nation's long history with other pandemics has prepared it for this challenge.
South Africa was able to build its capacity to undertake testing because of its TB and HIV epidemics. It's the same technology. The problem has been in South Africa that we can't buy enough test kits, because we are trying to buy the same test kits everyone else is trying to buy. And so we were constrained for a substantial period in just not being able to get enough kits. As that solution has been, as that problem has been solved, now we do have enough kits. We have been able to escalate our testing to around 40 to 50,000 tests per day.
The COVID-19 peak may have passed, says Karim, but the danger of a second surge remains. To that end, he urges South Africans to remain cautious. Anita Paul, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Even though sub-Saharan Africa continues to have relatively lower infection rates of the deadly COVID-19 virus, the lockdown restrictions due to the global pandemic have had an impact on the local economies. In fact, the World Bank is projecting that over 20 million Africans on the continent will be pushed into extreme poverty. Economists say that the strains on the healthcare sector will affect other systems, including the agriculture sector, and others. Edwin Ikuria is the managing director of the One Campaign, a global movement dedicated to end extreme poverty and preventable disease by 2030. He tells me that even as many of these African countries are constrained because of the COVID-19 pandemic, they are still required to service their external debts. What has been the impact so far from your view these lockdowns on the local population?
I think the major challenge has been the economic side of things, right? Which is basically the informal sector, because, you know, majority of the people they work in the informal sector. So it is more like you don't go out, so you don't have a way of earning money. You know, that was the main, impact, you know. But I think when they started reopening, you know, all of that, you know, changed. But I think the biggest part right now is that, I mean, Nigeria, or most of Africa actually, are very highly import dependent. And so they're not able to have international flights. So imports are highly restricted. And so you can't really get, people to replenish their stock in the retail sector, except for local goods. And even for local manufacturing, they need to import raw materials, right? And because the international flights are not open, international travel is not open, you know, the manufacturing sector that requires import basically are using up their own stock to produce. And after that, everything is going down. So you can imagine that this is having its own effect in terms of prices of goods, because people are hoarding, and for the few things that are available, the prices are just going up. Well, so yeah, that is tightening around, you know, access to, you know, to goods and services that is really important.
What is your assessment on how the government has responded to this pandemic, either from the shutdowns, whether it's in providing food and other social safety nets in the country? Obviously, people are suffering, which I'm assuming this makes your job as a person who is in poverty alleviation as a campaigner much more urgent. How would you assess your government's response so far?
Okay, first of all, I would say that there are certain conditions that make it impossible, you know, for the government to respond beyond what they have done right now. For instance, Nigeria is a heavily, it's an oil-dependent country. And as such, with the crash in the oil prices, with less international travel, so that basically means that the market for oil is down. So that in turn affects the fiscal space that is available for them to really act. And as such, what you've seen is a major response of almost 2 or 3 trillion naira. I don't know what that is in dollars right now, in terms of local stimulus, local urgent investment in the health sector, in terms of the response to supporting small SMEs and all of that. You know, there was a ton of money or funds that were spent to do that. But what you've seen is that we came from a very low base. So for instance, the level of testing that was happening was grossly inadequate for a population of almost 200 million people. So once you already began to see community transmission of COVID, if you do not ramp up testing as fast as you should, you know, it also means that you'll be missing out on a large part of the population. And the speed at which you could do that requires that, you work with international partners. And of course, that space is quite limited. So what you've seen is that in terms of the testing and expansion of the labs, it has grown from only 2 labs at the start of the pandemic to over 40 or 35 labs right now that are testing for COVID. That is a major milestone, because several people got involved, the private sector got involved. So you could really celebrate that. But in terms of the response vis-a-vis the extent of the problem, of the issue, like the population of the country, the number of cases that you could for community transmission, you would say, for those who have, in terms of the impact of the lockdown, you can't really say the response has been adequate, because very few people, for instance, I would say in the social safety net, the register of people who are the poorest that are supposed to be receiving cash transfers or that kind of stimulus. It's like 3 million. So 3 million out of 200 million. In a country where about 100 million are living below the poverty line, and when you put a lockdown, you basically just expand that net to almost 150 million people who are going to be living on less than, you know, below the poverty line because they can't go to work, they're losing their jobs and all of that. But if you're giving stimulus packages, or sorry, you're giving payouts or what you call cash transfers to only 2.6 million or almost 3 million people, that is like a drop in a bucket of an ocean.
Right. It's not enough.
Exactly, not enough. And now, you can't blame where it come from. That's the point. The point is that, you know, there's a lot of debt that the country has to service in the midst of the fiscal constraints. If you don't service those debt, it means you're also defaulting. And if you default, it means that you will lose access to further, you know, capital markets, you know, in the future. So all of these are just the impossible situation, what we call impossible choices that the government of Nigeria and almost several African countries have to face.
Absolutely.
And so that's the condition. That's where we are. And so you would say they've done their best. In the quick answer to your question is that the government has done its best within its available resources.
They're doing their best under the circumstances.
Out of the circumstances, exactly.
In case you're just joining us, this is Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Bungani. I want to thank you for tuning in today to the show. We continue our conversation with Mr. Edwin Ikuria, the executive director of the One Campaign in Africa, which is a global movement working to end extreme poverty and preventable disease by 2030. Even though it's too early to predict the full impact of COVID-19 on Africa, the World Bank projects that due to the lockdowns and other restrictions that were instituted around the continent by many of these governments, that the continent is likely to experience its first recession in 25 years as communities that had been making progress in their fight against poverty struggle with issues such as with weak healthcare systems, food insecurity, and, you know, generally a global economy that is in decline. But there's another layer to this. For a continent with a heavy debt burden, the public debt is estimated to be around 59% or a little more of the GDP. The IMF says that most African countries have borrowed more than is prudent. And so that means that even as they struggle with a health crisis, they still have to pay back their loans, service their loans. And it's fair to say that most of the money that is going in servicing these loans should instead be invested in their healthcare systems and also to stimulate their economies. Yes. Now, before COVID, there had been reports that around the African continent that many countries were registering success in fighting extreme poverty. And this pandemic is obviously a setback. Even though we have not seen the real impact yet, but your organization, whose mission is to fight extreme poverty, how do you approach your mission in this new reality? I mean, things were bad, but they're about to get worse.
Very true. So one of the things we've tried to do is to call attention to some areas that people could easily forget. For instance, we have a slogan, not a slogan, a tagline that says hunger could kill more people than the virus. So the issue of food security. And so when people, again, very associated to health, is that when if people are able to fight hunger, if people have access to food, they are likely to survive the disease, right? Because good nutrition means, you know, you have a higher immunity against the disease, right? So one of the areas we've been calling attention to is that we should not fight COVID at the expense of food security. And so we try to call attention to that, and by basically saying you need to open up the economy for at least farmers so that they can go to work and they can produce, especially if Africa imports, you know, a huge percentage of its food supply. You know, that is just this pandemic basically revealed the that the food system is not resilient enough. And so one of the areas we called attention to is about getting food security. And it means allowing farmers to go on about their businesses, you know, so that at least we don't die of hunger. Mm-hmm. That is on one side. And it also to also basically see that Africa can open specific corridors to allow food in countries where there's food excesses to be able to transport it to areas where they don't have enough food, especially in the landlocked countries and the areas where there is drought and, you know, flooding and those areas where food production is really less. So we called attention to that, and we are really happy that that call was heeded and many countries opened up, you know, at least for the farmers, made farming an essential service so that people can actually go to farm and produce. Mm-hmm. So that is on one area. The other end we've been pushing this is that there needs to be a fiscal response. And the fiscal conditions, right, and the fiscal space in the most African countries is very limited. So when more people are going to get into poverty, if the government does not have enough money to either stimulate the economy or at least, you know, cushion the effects of those who are losing their jobs. And so we've been calling for debt relief and basically asking the IMF, the World Bank and the G20 countries to put a debt standstill at least for the next 2 years, to say at least up to 2021, people can hold off paying debt. What we realized recently from the data that was published by the World Bank is that they have received more in debt payment than they have actually given out as credit, you know, or loans to four countries.
During this pandemic.
Exactly. Yeah, during this pandemic.
That is a little absurd, I'm sorry to say. But so, this pandemic has exposed, the pandemic has exposed some of the flaws in our systems, whether it's the food system that we're talking about, whether it's our health system.
Yes.
And, you know, we can see this in how the pandemic has affected both the rich and then the poor nations. My question to you, Edwin, is that how do we come out of this better? What lessons should we come out of this with?
Okay, I think, so there are several fronts with which we could do that. Number one, the first thing is that a health system is only as resilient as the, you know, their preparedness, you know, to fight diseases like this, right? So one of the ways we think we can combat better is if we begin to invest in health system strengthening, so that whether there is a disease or there's a pandemic or not, people are investing in that, because your economy will crash when there is a pandemic, you know? And so that is one lesson that we all need to know, that you don't invest in health systems, you're just, you know, setting yourself up for future failures, you know? That is one. On the other side is to think about how do we generate the right kind of, you know, jobs, you know, system jobs that can keep people secure. We saw what this pandemic did was that with an 80% informal economy, there is no way you can survive. So what we want to think about now is how do you formalize the informal sector, particularly in Africa? So what we see is that we're asking, how do you invest in a digital identity? How do you identify people? How do you bring them into a bracket where whatever they do, they are captured by the system? And as such, it is easier to reach them in the face of a pandemic. And it's easier to reach them in the face of an external shock, like something like this. So how do you transit the economy from an informal system to a more formalized system that you can then increase your tax bracket, you can then increase the identity of people that are, you know, can know the people that are actually, you know, productive in your economy. So there are several of these components that we've been asking for, these systemic changes. But more importantly is the international financial architecture, where you see that African countries, or not just African, poor countries that have very little to do to stimulate their economies. They cannot print money. But I can tell you that in the US and Europe, they are really practically printing out money, you know, giving out money to their citizens to stimulate the economy, to cushion the effect of unemployment. But we cannot do that. We don't have that leeway on the African continent, you know. And as such, we begin to think about how does the international financial architecture system, you know, work for the poor people, work for the poor countries, so that they also have access to resources like this to stimulate their economies in the face of a pandemic or an external shock like this. So there are several fronts that we are trying to push for this. But more importantly right now, at the moment, the most urgent need is that we need to all get a vaccine to make sure that this gets out of, to make sure that this disease ends, or at least people can reopen the way they should open. And for that to happen, the African countries or other poorer countries may be disadvantaged, because if a vaccine is produced, before it gets to the African countries, it should take some time.
Absolutely.
And we kept the slogan, we say that none of us are safe until all of us are safe. So none of these developed economies will go ahead and talk about, you know, their own safety as long as African countries do not have safety. So And the idea here is to think about when you produce or get a vaccine, it should get to the most vulnerable countries in the world, you know, as soon as possible without all of the trappings of, you know, intellectual property and all of the things and profiteering that could, deprive vulnerable countries.
Basically, make sure that there's equitable access to the vaccines.
Exactly.
Edwin, thank you very much for talking to us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, too, for having me.
You're listening to Upfront on The Voice of America. My name is Jackson Funganyi. That is Rwandan artist Davis D. And the song is Dede, which is also a perfect segue for our next story. And for that, we go to Rwanda, where an organization is providing support to 35,000 small business entrepreneurs in form of a one-time grant. That organization is known as Inkomoko Entrepreneur Development. Its managing director, Natalie Niyonzima, tells me that the funds are part of a $2.3 million grant from MasterCard Foundation will go to mainly refugee populations and surrounding communities as a way to ease the negative impact of COVID-19 and in other ways to support local entrepreneurs as they try to recover economically from the effects of the lockdown.
In total, we supported about 12,000, and only this year we're talking about 9,000. So the first criteria is to have gone through our program, whether this year or in the past. We are looking for, I would say, most of the refugee-owned businesses are in retail. And so the goal for the grant is to have those small businesses get back to their pre-COVID revenue and pre-COVID employment level.
SMEs that operate within the refugee camp themselves, run yes. by refugees.
Yes. Also, as part of integration or to improve the integration of refugees and the host communities, part of that pool will include Rwandans who live in the surrounding areas or surrounding communities of the refugee camps.
And why did you specifically target the refugee population and how does this affect, say, their relationship with their host communities?
There has been at the global level, I think at the country level as well, a change or a shift in strategy on how the refugees are supported in their host country. So traditionally, they used to get allowance in kind, whether it's firewood, whether it's soap, whether it's blanket, etc. And so a lot has changed, and I think the funding has been drying year after year, the funding towards supporting refugees. So this is a more sustainable way of helping them be resilient and help them probably graduate from assistance.
And what kind of businesses do refugees often run?
In most of the cases, they have corner shops or retail, so they are responding to the needs they see in where they are located, right? So you'll have corner shops with foodstuff, with really the, I would say, the basic necessity, whether it's soap or a candle or anything that is really needed in a small household in a refugee camp, and agriculture. I think looking at the economy of Rwanda, agriculture is really a big sector. So they're really involved in the primary production.
What's the size of the grants given to each of these entrepreneurs? And what criteria do you use to measure or to determine the financial needs of their business operations?
So the grant amount is really based on the size of the business. We have a range of from $100 up to $8,000. So it's really wholesalers would qualify for a larger amount than someone who's selling charcoal in a market. Yes, and also this grant is coming to supplement the services that we were already providing them. As I mentioned, we are a consulting firm and we're providing business training and consulting. So prior to getting this financing in form of a grant, they have received trainings in cash flow management or bookkeeping or in sales to make sure that once they get the grant, they will really know how to put it to use.
What kind of unique problems do refugees face during this COVID-19 pandemic?
That's interesting. That's a good question. I think it's very important before I respond to that. I think it's important to understand maybe the environment or the type of rights or no rights that they actually have. But I think in a large majority of part of countries, refugees don't necessarily have access to, they don't have access to free movement. They don't have access, they're not allowed to open business or have a bank account or even have a national ID.
Do you hope to continue the program? Because I imagine a one-time grant might be good for a certain period of time. But we are still very much in the midst of a pandemic and we don't know what is going to happen in a few months down the road. Are you hoping to continue providing this type of grants to these businesses?
Well, the support to the refugees in terms of training and consulting still continues. It is true that the grant is really a short-term solution. However, I think the priority for us was to really get to support them to get back to business because they're providing the much needed employment, the much needed product and the services that the community really rely on, and without which really the communities cannot, I would say, recover. Mm-hmm. And so part of also another service that we provide is really access to affordable loan financing through our sister organization that is providing loan at a below market interest rate. At the moment, I think we're still looking for more partners to see if more partners can come along and provide more resources. At this moment, we haven't yet found any other partner, but our support to them still continues in forms of consulting and training.
How many refugee camps, I'm gonna take off my hat since we're not doing this, you know, because it's really hard in here. How many refugee camps are there in Rwanda?
We have 6 refugee camps. But refugees are not only in camps. Some others decide to settle in urban locations. So we're actually present in 8 different locations, 2 urban and then 6 in camps.
Are they allowed to resettle into urban locations? Is that something that is legal?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Some refugees might choose to not go again because I've mentioned the refugee camps are really in remote areas. Mm-hmm. So for refugees who really want to take a chance on employment, it makes more sense for them to get close to an urban area where there are more opportunities.
Okay.
They come with degrees, they have skills, so really? That at different levels. Yes.
Okay. And that is, some of the considerations you make before you give out these grants, the type of knowledge and the skill sets they have?
Yeah, I think in terms of business, the level of degree or the level of education is not necessarily the first requirement you look at. When you think of the most successful business people in the world are not necessarily the ones who are the most educated. I would say it's also a consideration.
Natalie, so nice to meet you and so nice to talk to you. Thank you very much. I hope everything is well in Kigali.
Thank you so much for inviting me to your show.
You're so welcome. And with that, we come to the end of our show today. I want to thank you, all of you who tuned into the show, whether you were listening in live or on our podcast on our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on our Facebook and other social media platforms. I'm personally at Upfront Africa on my Twitter and Instagram handles. I'm Jackson Bungani in Washington. Please take care and be well.